First of all, I would like to thank the Fields Institute and the organizers for inviting me here and for giving me a chance to talk about the topic of the lecture, which may seem a strange title to you, first of all, if you don't know the topic, the chain rule as a functional equation. So let me begin by saying something about the motivation, which is actually one of the ideas which Vitali had, and I would say in the very beginning that this is joint work, as you have seen, with Shiri Artstein, Avidan, and Vitali Milman. And the idea Vitali had for some time now is that some fundamental operations in analysis and geometry are actually characterized by some very simple properties or by some very simple equations. So for instance, in geometry, polarity or functional version like Legendre transform are characterized by some simple properties like anti-monotonicity and some natural non-degeneracy conditions. Or for instance, the Fourier transform is characterized by mapping products into convolutions, and you need some bijectivity conditions on the space of Schwarz functions in this dual. And I put it down here, and I think Feifman will also give a lecture here with a different characterization of the Fourier transform, which is also very interesting. So this was the general background. And now what we were looking at is simply the derivative, I mean, as a operation. And the question was, can it be characterized by a simple functional equation? Now, the first thing you would think about when you look at the derivative is you take the product rule. But the product rule actually is not sufficient. There are many examples for operations satisfying the product rule. But there's also the chain rule. And the chain rule I put down here, the derivative of f composed with g is derivative of f composed with g times derivative of g. Let's use an abstract version of this. You take an operator T mapping C1 into C, so the space of continuously differentiable functions on the real line into the continuous functions on the real line. And so we assume that the chain rule is satisfied for functions f and g in C1. In the sense that T of F composed with G is T of F composed with G times T of G. And what I would also like to say is that we do not assume that T is continuous in any way or T is linear in any way. So at first we do not want to impose any other conditions besides having this chain rule functional equation. And the question is, what kind of solutions can you find? Can you find more solutions than the usual derivative? Of course you can, and I will give some examples. So the first example would be, you take a positive function h, continuous function, and you define an operation h composed with f divided by h. You need h positive, so or at least never zero, to make it sensible that it's defined everywhere for every continuously differentiable function, little f. And of course, this will satisfy the chain rule because, you know, by multiplication, you have h of f composed with g divided by h. It's the same if you in between have a term like h of g. So a would be one example which satisfies it. Then there's some sort of degenerate example. Suppose that for bijective functions on the real line, which are differentiable, you define TF to be the derivative, and zero otherwise. Yeah, so if the function is not bijective, you simply put it zero. This also satisfies one, because what you can convince yourself of is that if f composed with g is bijective, this happens exactly if f and g are bijective because you're on the real line. Not in general, but here you're on the real line. So actually, This chain rule simply applied to bijective functions guarantees that this actually also satisfies one. But of course, you know, it is degenerate in the sense if you have a bounded function or semi-bounded function, it would be zero. And of course, this is a strange situation. Now, the next thing, what you can do, if you have two operations, T1 and T2, you can form the product of them, and they will also satisfy this equation. And so more generally, you can take powers of the derivative. And to make it sensible, we take modulus to the power p, or you take modulus to the power p times the sine of f prime, and p positive, or maybe also p equal to 0, would satisfy the equation. Now let me introduce some non-degeneracy condition which we will impose, which is rather weak condition. Namely, if you consider functions, I will denote by C1b, which are bounded, well, not necessarily bounded themselves, but they should be bounded from below or bounded from above. Yeah? So in any case, the bounded functions would be part of this. Or here the situation, this I want to exclude. I want to exclude this example B. So we call a map non-degenerate if T is non-zero on C1B. So at least there's a semi-bounded function F where TF is not exactly equal to zero. So this is a very, very weak condition. But it's the condition which we want to use to remove possibility of B. So the next situation is sort of complete solution of the problem in the case that you map continuously differentiable function into continuous function. So we assume again T satisfies this chain rule functional equation, which you see there, and we assume it is non-degenerate. So this example B is not valid. And then, of course, you can combine this example A and example C, and you would get examples. So what you can do is you can take this first example, h of f divided by h for some continuous positive function, and then you multiply by f prime to the power p. And as I said already, if you multiply two examples, you get another example. And you could also multiply by the sine of f prime. So these are valid examples. And this is, and then of course these things satisfy the chain rule functional equation. So this is a complete characterization in the case of non-degenerate T's that any such thing satisfies the chain equation. And on the other hand, if this is satisfied, it has to have this form. Now, if you want to characterize the derivative itself, then you may assume some initial conditions, I would say. I mean, some additional condition like, so for instance, if T of f is the derivative, then you can take some rather trivial example, not the identity map, but twice the identity map. So you map every x into 2x. So then the derivative, of course, is 2. If you take p's power, it would be 2 to the p. So what we assume is that it is actually 2, if you take the value at 0. Then there's still a possibility that this function h intervenes, because if I only assume that t of this map x goes to 2x, if I know the value only at 0, then, you know, here at 0, it would still disappear, because f of 0 is still, for this map is still 0, so this would disappear, so this is still a possibility. But if you assume this for all x, not only at 0, but for all x, then actually this disappears and f prime is the only solution. You also have to assume that t contains function with negative values to remove this possibility, because otherwise you could take modulus of the derivative. And this we want to exclude by choosing this possibility. In future slides, I will use a bracket around sine of f prime to indicate that this and this are both possibilities. Right? I mean, just to have a shorter version of this, I will write sine of f prime in brackets, and then both possibilities are given. Now, if you look at the formula, maybe I will write it down again. So this was basically the solution. And if you take h to the 1 over p and take the antiderivative g, then you can write it in some way like this, and then so all solutions are some sort of generalized derivatives. What I should also mention going back is that there's no continuity assumption on t, and there's no linearity assumption on t, as I mentioned before. Yeah? The only assumption we make is that it's non-degenerate. And the linearity follows from some initial condition like this. And continuity is not used, not assumed, but follows, of course. Now the function h, which is in the formula, you can actually determine completely if you look on only at the function x goes to 2x, so 2 times the identity. And you do the following: you take this image, t of x goes to 2x, and this is again a function, it's a continuous function at x, and you normalize it by the value at 0. And then you have a function which is 1 at 0, and then you can take the product, and actually it converges, can be shown that it converges uniformly on compact sets. And this actually defines the function which we have there. This is sort of an outcome of the proof. There's a cohomological interpretation of this, which I just want to mention in passing. So you can introduce the continuous function as a module over the continuously differentiable functions by this operation of reverse composition. And then you consider the functions of the n-fold product of continuously differentiable function with images on M, and you introduce the co-boundary operators dn, and well, I don't want to give the definition here. Anyhow, it turns out that in this multiplicative notation, the kernel of TD1 is simply the solution of this chain rule. So these are the co-cycles, and the image of the D0 are just these maps which we have there, HF over H, and so these are the co-boundaries. And so if you take the quotient H1 of GM, this is simply represented by these powers of T, because, I mean, this is sort of the quotient you take off, so here you have representatives are the powers p and possibly the signs. But this I want to mention only in passing. Now, of course, you can ask yourself, why do you restrict yourself to continuously differentiable functions and continuous functions? Of course, this is sort of the natural setting if you think in terms of derivatives. You go one step below. But of course, you could also start from C2 function and you go to C1 function, or you could look at C infinity function, you go into C infinity function. And the result is very similar. So we take any integers k and l, k bigger than l, and then you assume that t maps ck into cl. So you go down at least one derivative. Maybe you go down more, but you go down at least one derivative and you assume the chain rule. Again, you assume it's non-degenerate, now on CK. Then again, it has the same form. Yeah. So This bracket here now indicates that both possibilities are given and valid possibilities. P has to be positive or at least not negative, and H now should be in CL so that the image is in CL. Actually, P should be either an integer between 0 and L, or P should be larger than L, so that actually it defines a mapping from CK, say, to CL. The result also holds on C infinity functions. If T maps C infinity into C infinity has this property, then for some H in C infinity, you have this form. Now you can look at the situation. This also makes sense if you take only continuous functions. The chain rule you could also formally define from continuous function to continuous function. T of FG equal TF composed with G times T of G makes perfect sense if you go from C to C. Now, if you assume that the image contains functions which have zeros, then actually the operator is rather trivial because on all these semi-bounded functions it is zero. So in this case you only have degenerate examples. And so actually what it means is that you have to go down one derivative in a sense. Yes? I mean, if you stay in the same level, somehow you only have trivial examples. We also have some versions of a weak chain rule, and this actually was an idea of Vitali to replace the T here by A, by some more general situation, and ask yourself, can you still have a very similar situation? The only difference which we need to make is that the degeneracy condition has to be somewhat stronger. I don't want to formulate it here, but you have to have a somewhat stronger non-degeneracy condition for T. You will also get from this formula a non-degeneracy condition for A as a consequence, and then you can show that T and A have a very similar form, except that now we have two functions, G1 and G2, which are positive and continuous. And okay, so here you have again G1 F over G1, but here you could multiply by G2, and in A you divide by G2 times F. Yeah. But in any case, it is very similar. And if you define H to be G1 over G2, A has a very similar form again. So even though you have a weak form of the chain rule here, basically you have the same result under some little bit stronger non-degeneracy condition. So next I would like to say a few words about the proof. What is typical with these approaches is that you need different kind of arguments for different kind of range spaces and domains of definition. As you have seen, C1, C, CK, C infinity, you have sort of similar results, but actually the proofs are rather different or involve different kind of arguments. So the results actually may depend very strongly on the domain of definition and the range space. At least the arguments do, and then of course you can think of other situations where you could formulate a chain rule and where the answer may be completely different. I mean, you could involve some distributions as well, and so, but this requires different arguments. Now, what is typical about the derivative and the formulas which I gave here is that they are local operations. They're defined point-wise. You define f prime at some point x. This is not clear from the formula somehow. You know, it's not allowed from the formulas that the operation would be something like an integral, where f is smeared around. You take all values from 0 to 1 or somewhere, but it is locally, and so this is the first step here, that you want to prove some localization property. So what you show is that if T is non-degenerate, we know that there's a function g such that tg of x is not zero, where g is sort of a semi-bounded function. But you can sort of make more requirements on g for any given open interval. You can require that the image is in g and that g maps certain fixed points x and y which you prescribe into one another. So this is some sort of shift and scaling, and you can use the composition rule to get more general results. So this non-degeneracy condition actually implies stronger condition, and this is something which we need in the later argument. And so the main look at C here, first of all, what you want to show is that if you have some interval, some open interval J, and F1 and F2 coincide on the interval, then TF1 and TF2 should also coincide on the open interval. This is the first step to show that actually TF is defined pointwise. So first of all, you don't do it pointwise, but you take a small interval. Now, if F2 is the identity, then you're in this situation that F restricted to J is the identity, and then T of F restricted to J should be T of the identity, and actually it's very easy to see from the formula that T of the identity is 1. So what you need to show is this. And I wrote down some argument here which actually uses mainly this kind of thing. But basically what you have to use all the time is the chain rule in some form, and you know, the point here is that if F restricted to J is the identity, then any map G which has image in G, in J, has the property that F composed with G is equal to G, and then you apply the chain rule here, and then you get that this is non-zero. Because this is non-zero, this has to be 1 here. So there are many small steps of this type here. This is only some indication. And then the next thing from this localization is that you want to prove that there's some function which we don't know anything about at this point from R3 into R, such that T of F at the point X is defined as this function of X, F of X and F prime of X. So this is this localization business. It only depends pointwise on X and of course on the function value, which needs to be, if you look at this formula, depends on the function value and on the value of the derivative. And it is pointwise. So this is the first step, and later on you have to analyze how this function f looks like. So the idea somehow is that you start out with some arbitrary function, and here you have your point x, and you want to make a break. And so on one side you take the function, and on the other side you take the tangent line. And you join these functions here, except for this point x. Actually, I called it x0 over there. And so you go from this function on one side, and you go to the tangent line on the other side. Now, so x0 is an R, you take a differentiable function, and you take these two intervals, and on one side you take the tangent line, and then you take a new function. On one part of R it is G, and on the other part it is F, and in the middle they join. Now, if you take these open intervals here, H restricted to J1 is G, and H restricted to J2 is F. And so by this previous property, as a property here, if F1 and F2 coincide on J, T of F1 and T of F2 coincide, and so this we can apply to this situation, giving this here, and the same on the other situation. Now T of G, if it coincides, the T of H on J1, it actually coincides on the closure of J1 because we have continuous functions. So we extend by continuity to the. But now this point x0, of course, is in the closure of both intervals. And so T of G at x0 is the same as T of H at x0 is the same as T of F at x0. So T of F at x0 only depends on the parameters where which show up here. But G only depends on F, F prime, and on x0. So this you can write down. It is a function of x0, f of x0, and f prime of x0. So this is sort of the localization step. Now the next thing is you want to look at the structural form of f in this representation here. So T of f, maybe I'll write it down again so you can follow this. Now we want to look how this function f looks like. I mean, it should have the form prescribed there, but we still don't know. So the first thing is that you claim that there are functions h and k with a property that k is multiplicative. K of u is 0 if and only if u is 0. And t of f is equal to h of f divided by h times k of f prime. Now later on the k should be simply the pth power. To show this, you take two points, x0 and y0, and you take functions which map x0 to y0 and y0 to x0. So these are functions f and g. And then you write down the composition of t f g, as you can see there. And since we are in R, we can interchange t of f at y0 and tg at x0 on this side, and then you have the composition of t of gf at y0. You see, the point is I want to prove some independence of x0 and y0 for this function k. So if you look at f of x0 times product, it will be the same as this thing with y0. Just reversing the sign, but of course in the right side you have the same. And this means that f of x0, x0, u is the same as f of y0, y0, u. So it is independent on the first coordinates if both of the coordinates are equal. And this we call k of u. And if you put over the x0 to be y0, you find out that it's multiplicative. And then if you introduce x0 and y0 back again, you can go from y0 to x0 and then from x0 to y0 again, and you get this formula. If you divide here, you find on the right side some expression depending on v, which actually does not depend on v because the left side does not depend on v, so you put v equal identity or 1. And you introduce some function g as 1 over this here and h, and it is easy to calculate with this function h that you have the form which you want to have. So this is some analysis of the situation, and now we have to find out what we can say about k and h. You have to remember that we did not make any continuity assumptions. So at this point, we do not know that these functions are continuous. We only know that the image of T is continuous. Yeah. But not the map itself is not continuous, but the image of T is consists of continuous functions. So TF is continuous. And now we have to use an old result of Sierpinski and Banach from the early 20s. If you have a measurable function which is multiplicative on the real line, then it is a power, possibly up to the sine of the function. So now we want to show measurability of our functions h and k first of all. And the chances are better for k, because k is multiplicative. But first of all, we have to consider h. And so here's the point where we use this function x goes to 2x, 2 times identity. And this is not. So here you have h of 2x over h of x, and this I call phi. Now, if you look at the formula here, here you have k prime of 2, you divide by this, and you put it here. And then you start some iteration procedure for a similar thing with h of b. You can take h of bx in a similar way, and well, it is some iteration procedure, which you can see here. And the continuity of this as a function, not as a function of b, but the continuity of this function implies the existence of this thing here, this limit here. And so h is a pointwise limit of continuous functions, and therefore it is measurable. So this is a kind of strange way of proving the measurability. And now you use f of x to be x squared over 2, then the derivative is x, what we want, because we want to have h of x, or divided by h of x squared over 2 times t f of x. This is measurable because h was measurable and t was continuous, and therefore now k is measurable, and so k is p power up to sine. On the other hand, you still have to prove the continuity of h. What we know is that for any function f which is in C1, h composed with f divided by h is continuous. So since you have so many differentiable functions, it should be sort of easy to prove continuity of h. And actually you can do, and I don't want to go through the details of this kind of proof here, but it's some analytic argument. You assume it is not continuous, and then because you can shift, you find it is sort of discontinuous everywhere, and it is sort of uniformly discontinuous in some way. And you find a contradiction to the chain rule. I don't want to do it. Now, there's an interesting point with the situation that you move on to, let's say, C infinity functions into C infinity functions, or CK functions into CL functions. Because you see, this kind of localization is very similar. So here you have your function. And now, if you work with twice differentiable function, you have to make sure in some point x0, the function is again twice continuously differentiable, so you have to approximate by a Taylor polynomial here. I mean, it will not be the tangent line, but it will be a Taylor polynomial of the appropriate order. And this means that the function f will also depend, like a Taylor polynomial, on the derivatives of order up to k. If you start here in ck, here you would also go to the kth derivative at the point x, because you have to make smooth functions so that you can actually operate t on this function which should belong to ck. But now if you want to show that actually you have the same result, you have to throw out all these derivatives of order 2, 3, up to k. So this is actually the problem, that it should not really depend on these, but only should depend on the first derivative. So again, you do similar argument as before, and then you can define again k, which is independent of x0. But now the problem is that this function k depends on the first derivative, second derivative, up to kth derivative. And then there's this nice property that now you have to look at the kth derivative of the composition. And there's this known formula, Fardi-Bruno formula, for the derivative of kth derivative of F composed with G. But it is a very complicated formula, and we only want to use a sort of stylized version of this, a very short version of this. In any case, for the second derivative, okay, you take, let me say, functions g, kth derivative of x0 to be tk, and kth derivative of y0 to be sk. Given any sequence tk and sk, you can find, of course, functions g and f which have this property here. Also in C infinity, but let's say for kth order. Now, I wrote down the expression here for the second derivative. So tk, the k index is the derivative order, and s stands for f, and t stands for g. So you have s1 t2 plus t1 squared s2, and s2 squared t2 plus t1 s2. So here you have the same product of the two derivatives here also, but here it is slightly different. And we want to use this slight difference to throw out this. Now, what this means is that the function should not depend on the second variable, because whatever this value is, and whatever this value is, it should be possible to make any choices of t2 and s2 to attain these values. So I claim k is independent of the second and further variables. You start with arbitrary a2 and b2, and given values of the first derivative, you want to solve that this is equal to a2 and this is equal to b2. And if you look at this equation, s1 and t1 are given, and it is evidently possible to solve this equation if s1 and t2, t1 is not 0, 1, and minus 1. Okay, if these degenerate cases appear, you have to make some other argument, but as before, you get that actually it does not depend on this variable, and it also does not depend on the higher variables, which is slightly more complicated, but along the same lines. So in any case, it depends only on the first derivative, the function, and the value x. And so the same thing as before applies, and you can use similar things. Now the only difficulty is here that your function h was only continuous. And now we need that h is differentiable, or several times differentiable. And there we need another lemma, which I formulate here, because we always work with this function 2 times identity, so h of 2x over h of x, which is essentially tf. This is now in CL, because tf, the image of t, was in CL. So what we want to show is that if h of 2x over h of x is in CL, h is in CL. And now we want to take, let's say we want to show it for C1. Yeah? L is equal to 1. Then you take the logarithm and you call this L. And then, of course, logarithm here would be like a function L of x minus something times L of x half. Here a would be actually 1, but in general you can also take some other a. And so you assume that this function is in C1, then you want to show that L is in C1. Yeah? And this is again some iteration procedure to prove this. So what you do, you look at this function and you define this, you look at this for values x over 2 to the j. So here you have x half, so next time you have x half, x over 4. And you adjust the factors a so that you have this telescopic sum here, and only the first and last term remains. Now, what you know, if a is less than 1, this is bounded here, a to the n goes to 0. So this goes to 0, and if a is equal to 1, the situation for C1 here, then actually this L of x over 2 to the n goes to L of 0. Because for L we know continuity, but we don't know differentiability. So now you look at L of x minus L of 0 divided by x. And so from this iteration procedure, because psi is differentiable, you check that this is equal to psi prime of 0 divided by this here. So this gives the differentiability and also higher order of differentiability. So now I want to mention some n-dimensional analog. So far we were considering the chain rule only for functions on the real line. Now I want to consider it for functions on Rn into Rm. Yeah? So I'm not considering functions from Rn to Rm, but I'm working on the same dimension from Rn to Rn. And the composition will be also by functions from this. So again, you have some half-bounded functions. So the image should be in some open half space. And then you have this non-degeneracy condition. And also I need some other condition, locally surjective, which means that Tf at x2 for a fixed x2. And if f goes through all c1 function, determinant non-zero, so invertible things should be containing all the general linear group. That's also something strange. You have to distinguish between n odd and n even. If n is even, these are sort of the well-behaved things. If the determinant is less than zero, and n is even, we have some special situation. And I want to formulate the result which you can prove in this case. So we assume that T is non-degenerate and locally surjective. And again, you have chain rule equation. T of fg at x is T of f composed with g of x. Well, here I should write maybe times Tg of x. This is composition of matrices, right? This would be linear operator on Rn, this also, and this is simply sort of matrix multiplication or composition of linear maps. But this is the form of the chain rule. And the answer here in this case is the following. You find again p and some function h. Now before the function was positive, and now it is a function on Rn with image in the general linear group. So h of x would be some invertible matrix. And for even n, there's a special situation that you have some diagonal matrix in addition, such that for any functions which are invertible at the point x, Tf is given by the following formula. So first of all, you have this determinant f prime of x to some power, possibly times the signum of this determinant. And then you have sort of an inner automorphism of the general linear group. You have the derivative here. On the left side, you have composition by hf. And on the right side, you have composition by h of x inverse. Now, in the real situation, of course, this would be commutative. So you could move this here. And then you have the same situation as before. There's a second possibility, which in our case really is a minor situation, that this f prime does not show up. You simply replace it by the identity. Or in this rather strange situation that n is even and the determinant is less than zero, you may have here some projection, typically of the form minus one and then ones otherwise. And this term, determinant sign f prime, might be missing. So it's a slightly more complicated situation. So you have sort of an inner automorphism followed by f times some character. I mean, the character in terms of the determinant of f prime. So I write it down here again, what I just said. And then you can make again some assumptions on the boundary terms. I mean, p is 0. And if you assume that t of 2 times identity is 2 times the identity, which means it's a constant function, then h is 1 and p is 0. or p is 1 over n. So in any case, what you get is that t of f is plus or minus f prime. So again, this condition will simply give you the derivative. And again, if you sort of make some negativity assumption, you can get actually the derivative itself. So again, there's a localization step which looks similar, but now you have to do n steps. I don't want to go through it again. And again, you have some multiplicativity here of some function of the same sort. But now u and v are maps on Rn, invertible linear maps somehow. And so now you have to study the general linear group, and you have to study automorphisms of general linear groups. And the main problem here is somehow that you don't have automorphisms, but you only have homomorphisms. But what we can show, first of all, by this local surjectivity assumption, is that these homomorphisms are surjective. And then from this property, you actually show that it's injective. And then you have automorphisms, and the automorphisms of the general linear group are well known. So we use some algebra in this case, and what you get is that you have a character multiplied by some inner automorphism, and then you have to compose it with a function f. And, well, the details, of course, are a little bit more troublesome in this case, but in any case, I hope I have given you a spirit of the work and of the ideas. So I think I will finish here.